But first, Rich Hall. Rich is a multi-award winning comedian, author, and a musician. He wrote for David Letterman and was a frequent guest on the show. Rich was also a cast member and writer for Saturday Night Live, Fridays, and Not Necessarily the News. In the late 90s, he created a character named Otis Lee Crenshaw, a redneck jailbird from Tennessee. For his performance as Otis, Rich received a prestigious Perrier Award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2000. He continues to perform stand-up and his own brand of musical comedy. Rich recently released a memoir called Nailing It, Tales from the Comedy Frontier. The book explores real-life experiences in which Rich really had to nail it. And spoiler alert, he nailed it every single time. The journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen says that it's rare for somebody to be as funny on paper as they are on stage, and I totally agree. So what is Rich's secret to getting the laughs onto the page?
When you're a stand-up comedian and you have an audience who immediately tells you if something works or doesn't, that's a pretty good bellwether for your comedy working. But when you're writing, you really have to fall back on what made you want to be a comedian in the first place was, I think I'm funny.
Mm-hmm. And you're right to think you're funny. You're very funny. You started your career as a journalist for the Knoxville News Sentinel. How did that gig turn into a lifelong career in comedy?
Because I didn't want to work for the Knoxville News Sentinel anymore. I was writing obituaries at midnight in a big empty building with nothing but an old typesetting room over my head. This is after studying journalism at Western Carolina University. This is after editing a newspaper. And the next thing I know, I'm just writing up dead people that I don't even know. And that just did not last long. It was a weird turn of events that made me look out the window one day and see a campus preacher named Jeb Smock, who weirdly only passed away a couple months ago and was still up to his dying day going around to campuses and evangelizing.
After you saw him, you returned to the university library and you kept thinking about what you had just witnessed. And you say that there was this comedic idea that occurred to you as a result of watching Jeb evangelizing. Can you tell us about that?
The idea was he would get the crowd together and really antagonize him. That, of course, drew more people. Pretty soon he'd have 200, 250 people. Some of them were heckling him. He was better than any comedian I've ever met at dealing with hecklers because that's what he did. He knew how to out-Bible anybody in the audience. It just occurred to me, not thinking as a comedian because I wasn't a comedian, wouldn't it be funny if you got a crowd like this together and after about 10 minutes, you suddenly just pulled the rug out from under him and did something to reveal that it was all a joke. It was a send-up of this guy, Jeb Smock. Mm-hmm. And that's what I decided to do. I had no real inkling that this would turn into a comedy career. It just seemed to me, I could go out there and after 10 minutes, suddenly I'm pulling out this giant album that says, it's God's greatest hits. That's why God is everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I started baptizing dogs. I'd get dogs out of the crowd and it was one of those things comedically when you know that you have a payoff and now mm-hmm. all you have to do is sort of reverse engineer it up to that point. And the payoff was I could exorcise a dog, if you poured a pitcher of water over their head and then say, denounce Satan, what are they going to do? They're going to shake like crazy. And it worked every time. It was great.
So how did you feel about your decision to pursue a comedy career once you started doing stand-up?
I just felt like, well, this is what I should be doing. And I also happened to start at a time when comedy was really starting to become a viable career choice. Suddenly, there were comedians all over TV, and I just thought, oh, that's what I want to do. I think after learning how to be a street performer, I thought the obvious next step is to get indoors.
Yeah, sure.
With a ready-made crowd. So by the time I reached the clubs in New York, it was astounding to me that there was a crowd already there. I didn't have to build it from scratch as a street performer.
I want to ask you about your showcase for David Letterman. It was at the Improv, and you had some high-profile company. In fact, you went on after Larry David. How did your set go over?
That set, that particular night, went over great because everybody was coming out. This was a showcase for the Letterman Show when it was coming to New York, and they were looking for writers, primarily. So all of us thought, oh, that, what a great gig that would be. So Seinfeld was there, Larry Miller, Paul Reiser. On this particular showcase for Letterman, everybody came out and did their tightest material, and they were great. So I did something different. Instead of doing my tight 8-minute, you know, showcase routine, I came out and badgered the audience into paying for a pizza. I was playing a Vietnam veteran who was a little unhinged, but he was a pizza delivery man now. And I decided I'm just going to walk through the audience and work my way to the back where I knew Letterman and his staff and writers and producer was, and just kind of harangue Letterman into paying for a pizza. It was crazy, but it worked. It really worked. So they hired me as a writer the next day. I went from going on to these late night gigs at the Improv and Catch a Rising Star in New York to walking into Rockefeller Center to my own desk overnight.
When I was in New Hampshire this summer, I was driving through New England, and I decided New Hampshire must have the world's greatest slogan on their license plate. You know what it says? Anybody? Live free or die. It's a pretty gung-ho attitude for a state to take, isn't it? Live free or die. You know, then you stop to think about the poor guy in prison who has to make these plates. You know? Boy. A sick joke on behalf of the state of New Hampshire, I think, you know?
What was it like writing? Well, like, how did you feel about writing for Letterman's morning show?
Well, I felt like the reason I was hired was because we had shared sensibilities, Letterman and I. And basically, anything he wrote for him, he made it better. I felt like almost right away we were on the same wavelength. I just kind of knew how to write stuff for Letterman. It didn't always work, but he would give it his best, you know?
Yeah, very well said, yeah. Let's talk for a minute about Sniglets, which you invented. What is the origin story behind Sniglets?
I was working on a show called Not Necessarily the News, and I wrote a sketch about a guy who gets called into the boss calls him, the dictionary editor. They're getting ready to put out the new annual dictionary, and he's gone through it and seen these words. Presumably, the editor has read the entire dictionary, and he's seen these words. He's seen one word. Wait, what is this? What is this? Cheetle. And the guy goes, yeah, it's the residue on Cheetos after you, you know, collects on your fingers after you've eaten them. And that's not in the dictionary. And went, oh, it is now. So the whole thing was a sketch. The producers looked at it and went, you know, you should just get rid of the whole sketch setup and you just come out and introduce these words. And I said, oh, right. And I, you know, I just named them Sniglets. I have no idea why. It just seemed like a good word. That's how it took off. And they became sort of a regular segment feature on the show.
It's one of my jobs is to make up words for things that should be in the dictionary but aren't. Sniglets, these are known as. Sniglet is any word that somehow got passed over by the dictionary. I don't know why. Like L acceleration. The mistaken notion, the more you press an elevator button, the faster it'll arrive. Motspur. The Motspur is that fourth wheel in the shopping cart that never gets along with the other three.
And they very quickly translated to books. Where they didn't work was on stage in a club. They didn't work that well. I'm just explaining them for a while. That was, it wasn't a massive annoyance, but it was a pretty annoying to go on stage and feel like I was letting people down because I go, I don't do Sniglets. And you could hear this collective. Mm. Oh, but we paid.
You invented a character named Otis Lee Crenshaw. Can you tell us about Otis?
That was my entree into musical comedy. I'm not a great musician. I'm way better than I used to be, but I could play piano at the time. But I thought, I know I can write funny songs, original songs, but I need a vehicle to deliver them. And I came up with a character who doesn't understand why nobody is recording his songs, but he's been in prison most of his life. And a good number of songs are about being in prison. He was very easy to channel because he was so many of my marginal relatives that I grew up with in the South, the ones, you know, coming out of the woods in North Carolina and Kentucky. It was a character I knew inside and out from the moment I created him.
We go out walking, just us two. Ain't much in this world I wouldn't do for you. And if a man with a knife said your money or your life, I wouldn't think twice. And I'd stand my ground and not give an inch. Coiled like a spring, I wouldn't even flinch. I would stare into the eyes of that son of a bitch. And this is what I'd say. Do anything you want to the girl, just don't hurt me.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that. You write in your book about this time when you were touring Australia in 2009, I believe. You end up writing a song that you, as Otis, and your band performed at a funeral for a man you'd never met. How did this happen?
Some people came backstage, just kind of barged in and started saying, oh, you're my granddad's favorite comedian. He loved you. And, well, huh? And then they said, oh, he just recently died. He reversed his car off a supermarket parking lot in Adelaide, and you got to come to his funeral. These people think this is a real character. He had a goatee, fake tats, Confederate bandana, but these people actually thought that he was real. So I went to a funeral as a character, then somehow ended up in a situation where they asked me to write a song, a eulogy, and everybody was hammered on this Rutgut rum called Bundaberg, which is like jet fuel and alcohol. And so I wrote a song about Bundaberg rum.
They used to think they'd make the drink that would turn the whole world upside down. One sip and the whole world would come for one sip of Bundaberg rum.
I mean, the grandfather was in the casket. They put a can in his hand, you know. That's how much of that stuff was going around. I ended up writing a song about that, sort of like a tribute to Bundaberg rum that these people loved, but was really pretty vicious takedown of the kind of people who drink Bundaberg rum. But they loved it. Hmm. And it became slightly anthemic. And that's when I knew it was time to get rid of Otis, that I'd taken this too far.
So can you tell me just a little bit about like the musical comedy that you do as yourself, as Rich Hall?
Yes, it's very country oriented.
Oh my God, it's a gorse fire. They say that the devil fans a flame. Oh my God, it's a gorse fire. My great granddaddy was to blame. Run away, run away. Take refuge in the USA. Well, they moved to West Virginia. They bought themselves a trailer. Never talked about it in the day.
To me, it's always been like, if you weren't listening to the song's lyrics, you would go, oh, this is a pretty good country song. Then when you hear the lyrics, you suddenly realize, oh, this is a comedy song, you know?
Yeah.
That's my approach now.
Since you have such a wonderful way with writing, I'm curious, have you ever thought about writing short stories or a novel or maybe both?
I did write a book of short stories called Magnificent Bastards about 12 years ago. And before that, a book of essays called Things Snowball. Nailing It is different in the sense that it's biographical. It's all about me.
Yes.
And not the gigs that define my career, but the ones that led to weird, weird situations.
Now that you've looked back on your comedy career and nailing it, what are you most proud of?
I'm always most proud of the last thing that I did. I don't really think back about, what's been your most crowning achievement? I'm very proud of this book. That was a great lockdown achievement. I think I made the most out of lockdown, that people look back and go, what did you do during lockdown? I go, well, I wrote a book, and it wasn't a cookbook, you know,
yeah.
Or a self-help book. It was a solid book.
Rich Hall, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on nailing it. Tales from the Comedy Frontier. You nailed it.
Well, thank you so much.
Rich Hall is the author of Nailing It, Tales from the Comedy Frontier. You can find out more about Rich and his comedy at wpr.org/beta.
Every single little piece of the paper, you know, every story, every opinion piece, every chart, graph was all about reacting to 9/11 with a mix of, you know, horror, sadness.
Coming up, filmmaker Julie Seebaugh joins us to talk about her documentary, Too Soon, Comedy After 9/11. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.